Charlotte, I've got to ask, do I look a bit gammon this week?
I couldn't possibly comment, but I wouldn't be surprised if I did see a plate next to you with a pineapple on it.
Yeah, I feel quite red. I think the sun's caught me.
Yeah, I certainly got caught a groundswell last week. And yeah, that's why I'm in the office today, making use of the aircon.
We certainly caught the sun at groundswell last week. And yeah, didn't get any complaints about the sticker we left behind on the groundswell Hollywood-esque letters.
Have you been stickering?
We have. It's not littering, it's stickering, because it then doesn't end up just wafting around in the countryside. It's stuck to something.
Is this going to be like where I see partisan supporters of sports teams putting stickers on road signs? Are you going to start doing that?
Yeah, next time you go to the Aston Villa toilets, not only will I stick up a Coventry City sticker, but there'll be an Agsho sticker under that. Once we've got supplies, because we ran out. We didn't bring enough. We didn't realise we were going to meet and swapsie with so many people, did we, Charlotte?
No, everyone wanted a sticker.
Hi, I'm Phil Maiden.
And I'm Charlotte Fawkes-Rees. Welcome to The Ag Show.
In this episode, we'll be talking GB Calf Week, a cross-industry campaign that brings together the latest research and new ideas in young stock care.
When I was a farm vet, we had a saying that in order to have progress, you had to measure it, manage it and monitor it. So it's really about having events where farmers can learn about measuring data in their young stock sheds and fields in really practical ways.
We'll also hear about the beef and lamb environmental roadmap.
We've got some important advice for farmers who've got very dry grain.
And we'll find out why one young farmer has recently run the length of the country.
It was sort of proof to people that farmers just take the punches and you still have to get to where you need to get to at the end of the day. You've still got jobs to do and, you know, how hard they work and the lack of recognition they get.
A reminder, new episodes of The Ag Show drop every Wednesday at midday, available wherever you get your podcasts.
With audio and video versions for every show, just subscribe to make sure you don't miss an episode.
And please do get in touch, because we'd love to hear from you. Comment on any of our social posts or email agshow@ahdb.org.uk.
Let's kick off this episode with a look at GB Calf Week, which is underway and runs until next Wednesday. This cross-industry campaign brings together the latest research, practical ideas, and expert advice to help farmers give every calf the best possible start.
Joining us today are a couple of AHDB specialists on this subject, animal health and welfare scientist Halcyon Hayward and Sarah Tomlinson, who's AHDB's lead veterinary science expert. So Hal, we'll start with you and let's start with the basics. So for anyone discovering it for the first time, what exactly is GB Calf Week?
So it's an industry campaign which started in 2022 with the GB Dairy Calf Strategy, and we've continued it on with the GB Calf Strategy. It's an opportunity for organisations and businesses to share the highlights of their latest research and ideas in young stock care, and it's a way for them to put on events and webinars for farmers so that they can learn about these topics too.
And you have a theme each year, and this year's is Smarter Starts, making data-driven decisions about every calf. So what does that mean in practical terms on farm?
So when I was a farm vet, we had a saying that in order to have progress, you had to measure it, manage it and monitor it. So it's really about having events where farmers can learn about measuring data in their young stock sheds and fields in really practical ways, and also using that information so that they can track progress and identify changes that would help them on their farms.
And where are you seeing examples of farmers using data particularly well to improve calf welfare?
So there are some brilliant new tech solutions in the market, things like sensors and shed monitors. But even low-tech ways can be really great opportunities to use data. So, for example, measuring and recording birth weights of calves and then again pre- and post-weaning can provide a real wealth of information about how those calves are performing in the system.
What are some of the biggest challenges that farmers still face when it comes to rearing healthy, productive calves?
Time and finding the time to make changes is something which is a really big challenge that I think a lot of farm teams would agree with. And when you've got an issue, finding the time to approach it and identify the root causes can feel like it's too difficult to do. But actually, that can really be the time that you figure out what a different approach could do and help to relieve some of that burden. So we know that making a difference in a calf's management starts well before they're born. So those breeding management choices and that cow's nutrition, as well as the environment they're born in, all have an impact. So taking some time to think these things through can really help.
And if a farmer listening wanted to make one improvement tomorrow that can have a lasting impact, what would that be?
It'd be really overwhelming trying to change a lot of things at once. And I think Calf Week events will really help to highlight that using data can help you prioritize those issues and just focus on one area, set yourself some targets, what you're going to measure it and how, and then go from there.
All of that, it really sounds like, and it's a real common theme that we have with a lot of the guests coming on, data is power. The more you know, the more, you know, it almost sounds counterproductive that you need to take time to look into these things when you're really time poor. But it really does help in the long run, doesn't it?
It does. Sometimes if you make a few minutes or even half an hour to sit down and spot what the real issues are, you save yourself so much time in the long run.
And that's when it's also really worth just talking to other people around you too, isn't it? You know, you might be dealing with your vets quite regularly. You know, it could be other farmers that you're friendly with. Just having a chat and just finding out how other people are doing it can be really valuable too.
Definitely. And getting an outside perspective can sometimes really help. So if you've got an issue, sometimes it feels like you can't do anything, and just having a chat with someone else, they might have an idea that could really kick things off.
And usually they're really simple ones is what I find. You talk to someone else and they're like, oh, why did I not think of doing that? So yeah, get out there and talk to people is what I take from that too. Now, Sarah, you've been waiting very patiently, but this next question is going to be for you. If you take us back right to the beginning again, what really prompted the development of the calf strategy and why was that needed?
Our calf strategy, which Hal said was a dairy calf strategy, had a really, really specific issue, I guess, that farmers and the industry wanted to tackle, which was the euthanasia of dairy bull calves. It was a big sort of expose. It was a reputational risk to the industry. So they came together and owned it and said, right, let's find some of the solutions. And actually, we have eliminated routine euthanasia of dairy bull calves. And that's predominantly been through the increase in use of female sex semen in the dairy industry. We just don't see dairy bull calves being born. I think it's 69% reduction in dairy bull calf registration. So we just don't have them on farm. But that meant that beef semen was being used on the rest of the dairy herd. So we've seen a 74% increase in dairy beef, which is great for our domestic beef production because it fills part of that market, reducing the need for imports. But we brought the industry back together and said, right, do we need to carry on with the GB calf strategy? And actually, it was potentially the beef sector that felt that it was needed more than the dairy sector, because the welfare and even the environmental impact of rearing beef was the reputational kind of risk that the industry wanted to show we were tackling and improving all the time. We came together and sort of developed this rearing every calf with care and a purpose. And it's every calf. It's not just dairy beef. It's suckled beef. And the purpose is, you know, if you're breeding for replacements, whether that's in the dairy herd or the beef herd, or whether you're breeding them for the beef supply chain, they are all bred with that purpose in mind. And the GB Calf Week is all about, you know, maximising that productivity, improving welfare and reducing that environmental impact that those supply chains have.
And I suppose that then just really highlights how important it is to have that collaborative approach to this. It's not just one sector in isolation that's having to deal with it. And this strategy can really help with bringing together different organisations.
Yeah, and I think the other thing is, quite often farmers, I was a farm vet as well for a long time, farmers feel that all of the pressure is on them to change, whereas actually this isn't. This is about bringing together the industry across all of those supply chains, vets, farmers, researchers, scientists, processors, retailers, to support the farmers to be able to make those changes, whether that's through financial reward, helping them with the tools like the data, like Hal said, the genetics information to be able to make those decisions easy at a farm level.
Thanks both. It's been incredibly interesting hearing all about that so far. And we'll be hearing more about GB Calf Week later in the show.
Hi, I'm Alice Perry with the top AHDB news. A welcome boost to the Sustainable Farming Incentive will see an extra £50 million made available next year, taking the total budget to £290 million. Farmers are being encouraged to plan ahead of the second application window opening in September. We've launched a new tool to help winter wheat and winter barley growers manage the risk of barley yellow dwarf virus. The tool uses a wider range of risk factors to support more informed sowing and spraying decisions. Our latest dairy trade review shows UK cheese exports have reached an all-time high, with export volumes up more than 15% in the second quarter, although overall dairy exports fell as other categories came under pressure. And Enrique Fernandez Pino has been appointed to the AHDB board, bringing more than 30 years' experience in digital, data and technology roles across the public and private sectors. That's all for now. Find out more at ahdb.org.uk.
Welcome to AHDB's Forage for Knowledge update for Thursday, the 20th of August. Tough to comment on grass growth when there is so little about. Parts of the north and Scotland are still achieving reasonable growth, but less than 20 or below in the south. The drought has changed how many cows have been managed this summer. Changing diet may have impacted body condition score, which could have knock-on impacts on fertility down the line. If you're not sure, take 20 cows, assess the spine, long and short ribs, and then do the same in 3 weeks and compare their condition. This will make gradual losses easier to spot. Don't forget to check on young stock too, weighing to see if they are on target and if diet changes need to be made. I'm Emily Udall. For more analysis and commentary from Piers Badnall, go to the AHDB website and search Forage for Knowledge.
Hi, I'm Alice Perry. Here's your AHDB news for the week commencing the 20th of July. An independent review of pig training provision has recommended a more coordinated approach to developing skills across the industry, with clearer pathways and closer collaboration to help attract and retain the next generation. Pig meat burgers were a standout performer in food service, according to our recent insights, with volumes up 38.7% in the year to the 14th of June. Beef burgers also returned growth. The increases came despite overall red meat volumes declining slightly. And our latest dairy market analysis shows recent heat waves have affected GB milk production. June deliveries were 3.1% lower than a year earlier, with heat stress adding to pressure from lower herd numbers and tighter margins. That's all for now. Find out more at ahdb.org.uk.
Welcome to AHDB's Forage for Knowledge update for Thursday, the 16th of July. This week, average grass dry matter was 21.8%, ME at 11.3% and protein at 21.1%. Growth rate's average is showing at 35 kilos of dry matter per hectare per day. However, this is skewed as many areas are hot and dry with little to no growth and therefore no plate metering taking place. Where there has been rain, aim to keep a simple 21 to 32 day round and entry covers at 2,800 to maintain good residuals. Elsewhere, look to lengthen the round to look after the grass, clover and herbs. Too short a round means plant recovery is impacted and there would be slower regrowth 2 to 3 weeks after the rain has come. When it does rain, hold off on the nitrogen until you have grazed the regrowth, as there will have been a build-up of soil nitrogen and over-applying could make regrowth less palatable. I'm Emily Udall. For more analysis and commentary from Piers Badnall, go to the AHDB website and search Forage for Knowledge.
With record temperatures accelerating harvest across much of the country, growers are facing a new challenge. Hot, dry conditions are quietly reducing grain weight through low moisture levels. And some are asking whether rehydrating grain before it leaves the farm could help recover some of those losses. We're here to set the record straight. We can understand why this may seem an attractive option, but we need to look carefully at the associated risks. In cereals, food safety risks increase when moisture levels are above 14.5%. Introducing moisture can trigger germination, which is something we need to avoid until the intended timing. Even a few germinated grains in a load can reduce the Hagberg falling number to an unacceptable level. And pre-germination in malting barley is easily identified at intake. both things will cause the load to be rejected. It's important to remember that grain leaving the farm won't be at the end of its storage period, and these issues will still impact the whole supply chain. But when grain is stored below 13% moisture, it effectively prevents mites breeding, mould formation, and the resulting mycotoxin presence. So while re-wetting may appear attractive, the potential gains are usually outweighed by the risks of quality losses and load rejection. The safest approach remains straightforward. Follow best practice for grain storage and check out our grain guides for more information.
Thanks, Sarah, from our very own Beck Hurstman. And this is something actually I have noticed farmers are quite wary about, the implications of having dry grain. In fact, I noticed someone combining early the other morning because they're combining to try and get out there in the field while there's still some moisture in the grain. So it is quite a significant issue, I'd say. And it's something also that we in the AHDB press office have been having a few inquiries about. So it feels like this has been an issue that's been dotted around the country. So if it's something that's affecting you, please take heed of Beck's advice.
Absolutely. And something that is also probably affecting you, what we get to call you, because I launched this, what, 2-3 weeks ago, suggested that aggers should be what we call ag show listeners. But Charlotte, you've had another suggestion, haven't you?
Yes, I had one of our listeners reach out because they understood where I was coming from, that aggers wasn't probably quite the term that they were looking for. So their suggestion was the ag mob or ag mobbers.
I'm wondering, is there something we can do with a play on agronomists? But I haven't quite worked it out yet.
Let's start with ag and then just put a gr after it and you've got an agger. That's it. That's your play on agronomists. Moving on, shall we do proper news now? I want, by the way, Charlotte, I want name and contact details of this person. Just so
that
I can...
Don't put them off listening. The whole point is they're meant to listen. We should be listening to our listeners, Martin.
Yeah.
We need more ideas. That's what I'm getting out of this. We need some more ideas. I've chucked it out there. Is there a play on agronomist? I can't think of anything because all I've come up with is ag show at Mr. Matt's awful. So if anyone can help us, at the moment, if I was going to vote, I'd give Charlotte the lead.
Whatever. Just get on with the news then between us. Charlotte, you can kick off.
Throwing all his toys out the pram. But it's only a quick one from me this week. And it's just to say that nominations are now open for the prestigious David Black Award. Now, the award has been recognising outstanding contributions to the British pig industry for more than 60 years and celebrates individuals or organisations that have made a lasting impact on the sector. Previous winners have included producers, industry leaders, academics and welfare champions who have really helped with driving the industry forward. This year's award follows the posthumous recognition of Robert Beckett at the 2025 National Pig Awards. So if you know someone who's gone above and beyond for the British pig sector, now's the time to put their name forward. To nominate, you can head across to the AHDB website and search for the David Black Award. And I'll also make sure that it's linked in our show notes.
And talking about someone who's gone above and beyond, I've recently caught up with a young farmer who's just run the entire length of the UK. That's right, you heard that right. The entire length of the UK in 17 days. That's 870 miles in 3 weeks. And I worked that out on a calculator because I'm not very good at maths. That's about 50 miles a day of running.
Wow.
In this weather too.
Incredible.
Will Circombe, congratulations and thank you for joining me, Ag Show. Just tell us, why John Groats to Land's End?
Yeah, I realised I wanted to do something because I've just finished uni, starting my job in a few weeks. I had this time, so I thought I could maybe do one more challenge. And there's just something appealing about the adventure of running the length of the UK.
How did you cope with it? How did you get your body to get you through it?
Something I'm probably still asking myself. So I've run a lot the last few years and sort of been building it up. Training wise, I did 100k a week, then just added 20k all the way to 200k. So I'd got a few miles in the bank, but not quite the same as what I was going for in this these 2 weeks. I've always believed that you can do more than you think you can. And it was very much, I was just going to try and do it as fast as I could. Like, mum, I remember when we got there, mum was like, oh, why didn't you just try and do it in like 3 weeks, a month? And I was like, because imagine I could do it in like 18 days, 17 days. And so that was always the aim, just push myself as far as possible to see what I could do and try and sort of find the limits, so to speak. I had a few blisters along the way. I always knew that was going to happen, but we managed to manage them. I had an issue with my left knee. It's sort of just very swollen. That was about the fourth day. It was a point that I was even scared to like stop to take a quick toilet break, because if I stopped for so long, my knees would just seize up and it wouldn't be able to get going again. So that day I just tried to keep on moving and moving until I got to the 50 miles.
And obviously we've talked a bit about the physicality of this challenge, but also psychologically, you needed some motivation. And just explain a little bit about why you did this challenge and what it was that was motivating you for those 850 odd miles.
The whole reason I was there was because of my dad. 2 years ago, he got diagnosed with stomach cancer. And unfortunately, after about 14 weeks, he passed away. And it was because of that, I just thought running's always been a good way for me to cope with things and process. So it was a positive double-edged sword, is what I tell people. And so I could help process it and then try and do a good for some other people. So that's the aim, try and raise money for other families, try and prevent them from going through the same thing.
And your dad was a farmer, so he was well known in the farming community. So I'm guessing you would have had quite a lot of support coming from the farming community while you're on your challenge.
Yeah. So he was. He was the chairman of the NFU Livestock Board for about 6 years and had roles in various places. So I think relatively quite well known in the farming community. But also it was to try and recognise farmers a bit. Not at the time, but since. I'm very glad the weather was the way it was, because it was sort of proof to people that farmers just, you take the punches and you still have to get to where you need to get to at the end of the day. You've still got jobs to do. You know, how hard they work and the lack of recognition they get. There was a part of that trying to show that. So yeah, and the other brilliant thing with the farming community, so when we started getting to England, we started getting in contact with a few of our friends and they knew people along the route that we were staying at. So we were able to stay there with our camper van and they'd give us, you know, water, electricity, whatever we needed. Some of them like washed our clothes, you know, really did just help out. And it was just like a really sweet moment, really, each time. Obviously very much struggling, but there was just that nice just little note to it all that farming is a great community and that's why I definitely need them.
And family too, because you had family supporting you along the way, didn't you?
Yes, family is crucial. So my poor mum, she joined me the whole way along. She drove, so we hired a camper van. She did a very, very good job. So keeping me fed and watered. And her friend, a good friend, Caroline, also joined. I could not have done it without them too. All meals, like I say, as soon as the day was done, I didn't hardly move. So they'd bring me water and drink, some food, and completely looked after me. Absolutely crucial. And also, no, my family and friends are very, very good. The amount of people I had coming to like join for the day and run further than they ever have before or come on the bike, it was really nice. And that's what, again, started to make it a bit more manageable, sort of having that extra support.
Was there any moment that you particularly remember from it? Any kind of milestones or little kind of memories that you'll always cherish from it?
Yeah, there's quite a few. It's funny because a lot happened, but not a lot happened almost because I just was running every day. A certain low was, yeah, definitely. I think the lowest low was definitely end of day three. So I'd really struggled that afternoon, but really struggling to get up to where I wanted to. I think after day was finished, I took about 5 steps and just didn't have a shower. I was just laying in bed, just really thinking. I could see it in my mum's eyes. That was the problem. It was like I could see in my mum's eyes. She knew that I was, you know, not in the best way, just sort of sat in bed sweating, struggling to move, in quite a lot of pain. How I got up that the fourth day and carried on running, I don't know. I'll have to blame dad for that one, but that was the lows. But then some of the highs, leaving Scotland, very much really enjoyed that. So that was the start of the eighth day, and had some friends and family join that day, so that was very nice because Scotland was very hard, very lonely. And probably the second best moment bar finishing was going across the Severn Bridge going into Bristol, because I went to uni at Bath. So I knew roughly where in the country I was along the way. But when I got to Bristol, I was like, I really knew that I was sort of getting there and like the finish line was in sight. So that was a nice moment.
And just to finish on this bit, but have you got any message to your mum if she's listening? Because sounds like she might deserve a little bit of credit.
She deserves a lot of credit. I've always said my parents were always the best, but I think my mum is one of the kindest people I never know. She always does things selflessly, and she does never get the recognition because, again, it's something like this that some people think it's more about me, but it's all about everyone around me that supported me to help me to make it happen. And no one did any more or does any more for me than my mum. So a lot of the credit has to go to her, definitely.
Sticking with the news, if you've spent any time in the livestock sector recently, you'll know there's a growing focus on sustainability and reducing environmental impact. But for many farmers, the big question is, what does that actually mean on farm?
We're joined by our technical head of environment, Rachel Madeley-Davies, to talk about the Beef and Lamb Environmental Roadmap, which was released this week. So we're going to find out what it is, why it's important, and what it means for farmers in practice. Rachel, welcome back to the show.
Thank you. Thanks for having me back. Not banned or something.
We had you in winter last time. Now we've got the heat of summer. So let's start off with the basics then, Rachel. What actually is this environmental roadmap? And why did we feel that now was the right time to launch it for beef and lamb?
Great question. So actually, this isn't the first edition. This is the second iteration. So we launched the first version a year last sort of February time. And that was almost setting out our stall, sort of where we're at, what do we need to do. A bit of a sort of a stock take, really, in terms of both sectors. But what we've done now is we've convened an amazing collaborative cross-industry stakeholder sort of technical group. You know, and this does cover both England and Wales. So it really demonstrates great collaboration, particularly from our processing sector, who obviously, you know, they work across the border. They don't see, you know, sort of devolution. And we've had technical experts, and we've really sort of drilled down into terms of where we really need to be focusing on at the moment in terms of our sort of journey for improved sort of environmental sustainability across both the beef and lamb sectors.
What would be some of the main environmental challenges that this roadmap is trying to address?
Yeah, so although this is a roadmap now, I think we're really clear props in what the roadmap covers, but also what it doesn't cover. I think it's really key that we don't shove everything into one document, because we all know that our livestock farms, you know, have so much to give. You know, there's so much, you know, in terms of in the environment, you know, the fact that we've got interlinkages with, you know, improved biodiversity on our cattle farms, or in terms of how we manage water on them. There's loads of things we could have talked about, but actually we had to really sort of narrow it down and start somewhere. So this particular sort of iteration of the roadmap focuses on carbon. Although we do acknowledge, you know, the broader sort of environmental impact, but we really start to focus on actions that farmers can take to decarbonize their farms that actually are either cost neutral or cost negative. So it's almost like the low hanging fruit. So I think it's a really important step in terms of perhaps, again, identifying where we're at with these actions, but actually therefore, you know, what are the gaps, but also what are the opportunities going forward?
I like how you just sum that up, getting the low hanging fruit, the things that in theory are easy to do. Because as soon as you probably say to someone, oh, here's an environmental roadmap, everyone's going to think, oh my goodness, this is going to be really technical. This is going to be really difficult. It's so formal, it's going to be really prescriptive. But actually, I'm guessing this is then going to be taking into consideration how different people are farming, that there are different challenges for beef, for lamb. And what might you then suggest from this very technical roadmap, what, you know, a key action might be, or a couple of the key actions that people could be doing on their farm?
It's worth everyone remembered that this has been completely evidence-based. So we've used data here. We haven't plucked things out of thin air or thought what we'd quite like to do. It's all about evidence. And what does the evidence tell us? And therefore, how do we know what works naturally, what works for our farms? And that's really key in terms of actually how we actually get that change at farm level. So I think my view is always that all these actions, it's a bit like a jigsaw puzzle or a pick and mix almost. It's a bit like Woolies back in 1994, where actually you could pick what you fancy and what suits your farming business. And I think that's really key. Some of the actions we go into, so for example, we look at nutrition, we look at animal health, we look at genetics and breeding. You know, for some farms, actually, they're already where they need to be in terms of genetics and breeding or in terms of nutrition. But actually, they might feel that they want to dial up a little bit more around soil health. So they might want to improve their pH or perhaps reduce compaction. So for us, it's about farmers really taking the information and then applying it to their own farm, their own situation, and actually what suits their system.
Rachel, this roadmap, how does it balance environmental goals with the other key things, farm profitability and food production?
It goes without saying, you know, that all these actions, because they tend to be the low-hanging fruit, that actually they're cost neutral, they're cost negative. And it does start to overlay, you know, the correlation between being more productive from an environmental sustainability perspective, so you're more efficient in that way, and actually the fact that actually it correlates with making your business more productive. And also, I think you'd also want to introduce at the same time the fact that, you know, we've just had a very robust 25-year farming roadmap. It's a vision, and actually we need to make sure that we're demonstrating that as well for our long-term license to operate, which is underpinned in terms of economic and environmental sustainability. So it does it in a sort of an indirect and a direct way, if that makes sense.
How will what the roadmap's trying to deliver actually be implemented? Is it encouraging farmers to...
Hi, I'm Helen Plant, lead analyst at the AHDB, with a quick update on grain and oilseed markets for the week commencing Monday 17th August. UK wheat futures are currently around £200 per tonne, with Paris rapeseed futures over £470 per tonne. Grain and oilseed prices remain supported by the ongoing conflicts in the Black Sea and Middle East. In particular, shipments from Russia and Ukraine are being limited by the conflict at a time of year when large volumes are usually being exported. While some exports are still leaving, the level of these exports is going to be key for prices over the coming weeks. The market is also continuing to assess the damage from previous hot, dry weather in Europe, particularly on maize and sunflower crops, as they were at earlier stages of development than others. Expectations are still high in the US for their maize and soybean crops, though variable weather has cast some doubt over the forecast. With harvest due to start next month, the market is watching closely. Stay up to date with the latest data and analysis across arable, red meat and dairy markets. Head to ahdb.org.uk and click on Markets and Prices.
Want to get more from your suckler herd? AHDB's Stronger Herds for Stronger Returns campaign is hitting the road this autumn. Join September Farm Walks with housing expert Jamie Robertson alongside environmental and genetics specialists, or attend October discussion panels covering nutrition, animal health and performance. Share ideas with fellow producers and leave with practical tips to help future-proof your herd and business. Find your nearest event at ahdb.org.uk.
Feed it, or is there anything more that we'll see being done?
I think this is a vital question. This isn't AHDB's roadmap. This is industry. So it's all of us throughout the supply chain, from farmers like me to retailers, all of us, basically, this belongs to us. So I see that actually different parties and different stakeholders can use this in different ways. So there are perhaps farming organisations or farmers themselves that can actually get some ideas in terms of what might work here. But also, I think it's a really useful document to demonstrate that A, as an industry, we're collaborating. We work together across the whole value chain. But B, you know, we're owning this space. We're doing something about it. You know, we're demonstrating our improvements to date, but we're also demonstrating what we can do as well. So I think it therefore has two roles in terms of what we can do on farm to improve, but also still demonstrating to those, perhaps policymakers, governments, consumers, that actually we're already doing some great space, but actually we can do a bit more as well.
And I'm going to finish on the classic question now, Rachel. What does success look like? How are we going to measure it?
Success looks like a year from now that we're having conversations, whether they're in Westminster, whether they're at Groundswell, whether they're at the Royal Welsh, wherever they are, people are referring to the beef and lamb environmental roadmap like it's the Holy Grail, like it's our Bible, because they said, oh, actually, hang on, we've already, you know, in our roadmap, it demonstrates we're doing X, Y, and Z. So I think for us, it's people really start to see it as a trusted value document for wherever you stand in the supply chain, whether you're a farmer, processor, retailer, or an allied industry, that you can be really sort of, you can utilise it and you can trust it.
Thank you so much, Rachel, for taking us through the roadmap. And if any of our listeners would like to find out some more, head across to the AHDB website and you'll find all the details on there. And I'll make sure that it is also linked in our show notes.
Hi, I am Yuri Ruban, analyst at the AHDB, with a quick update on the grain and oilseeds markets for the week coming in Monday, the 13th of July. Recently, grain market prices were supported by re-escalation conflict in the Black Sea and the Middle East, as well as concerns about European crops due to the heat wave. However, the harvest season in the Northern Hemisphere brings new supply to the market and it's limiting prices rises. In the short term, the market is closely watching to the US and Black Sea maize crops. These are in key development stage called silking, and so far it's thought that the rain has helped support crop conditions. Oilseeds market were also supported by increase in geopolitical risk and crude oil prices, as well as weather concerns in the US, Canada and Europe. The hot weather is a risk for rapeseed and sunflower yields in Europe, with a higher temperature also a concern for the rapeseed crops in Canada. To stay up to date with the latest data and analysis across arable, red meat and dairy markets, head to ahdb.org.uk and click on Markets and Prices.
When the heat kicks in, farming doesn't get any easier. Livestock feel it, crops feel it, and so does everything else keeping the farm ticking over. That's where AHDB's Weather and Climate Resilience Hub comes in, with practical guidance to help you handle hot weather and whatever extremes come with it. Plus, the On-Farm Action Planner helps you spot risks, prioritise and build a plan that works. Search AHDB Climate Resilience and get one step ahead of the heat.
You're listening to The Ag Show. New episodes dropping every Wednesday at midday. But right now, let's return to the first topic of this show, GB Calf Week, which is in full swing right now. Hal, Sarah, thank you so much for staying on. Now, Hal, coming back to you very quickly, I think one of the really important things that we have within this week is all the activities that we've got going on. Are you able to help our listeners find out a little bit more about what we might have in store during the week?
You can find out what events are happening near you on our website if you search for GB Calf Week. Some of the highlights include webinars and events run by vets and some organisations. We're going to be at the Royal Welsh Show. And Carl, friend of the show, has got two sessions in Carlisle on the 21st of July, where he's going to be with some really brilliant speakers going through antibiotics in calves and how to prevent disease and keep them healthy.
I have to say, any listeners, if you get the chance to go to any of Carl's events, they are always worth attending. They're so informative and he makes them go through in such a way that are so enjoyable to listen to. So top tip from Charlotte, go to one of Carl's events, even if it is all the way up in Carlisle, which is a little bit of a trek. Now, Sarah, one of the aims is to improve outcomes right through the supply chain. How does this better calf management really contribute to producing things such as consistent beef for consumers?
Yeah, so again, when we brought everybody back together, you know, one of the outcomes was promotion of GB beef and people wanting that consistent product. So people go back and buy a steak the next week. It was felt that actually through the genetics, through, I suppose, getting a consistent way of measuring and monitoring that throughout the supply chain would lead to that in the end. And also it was that consumer confidence, like I spoke about, you know, them being confident that they were really eating some of the highest welfare, lowest environmental impact beef to keep promoting that British beef trademark, and that we could keep that domestic supply with increasing, I suppose, the outputs from the beef sector by minimising losses, you know, longer periods to before slaughter, all added to that promotion of that good British beef that was consistent and repeatable.
And I suppose that kind of feeds back, doesn't it? So in my day job, we're looking all about what the consumer wants. And knowing that, you know, meat can be quite an expensive part of their diet when you think about what's on a plate, making sure that the value that they're getting from that spend is good and it's what they're looking for is really important. So have you found that the different advances, with obviously using things like sex semen, has that helped speed things up?
One of the things that we're trying to do as AHDB leading on the right calf pillar of the strategy is to look at the genetics of dairy beef and how we can help the dairy farmers who are ultimately the start. They are beef farmers. They're the start of that beef supply chain. So it's that mindset shift that even though they might be selecting that beef semen for easy calving, short gestation, because it's the dairy, the milking cow that they're interested in, that actually how do we help support, incentivize them to make a good decision on that beef semen to ensure that the next part of that supply chain is profitable, viable, sustainable all the way through. So that's been, so I suppose the tricky bit is helping dairy farmers understand that they are beef farmers and they're the beginning of it, and ensuring throughout that supply chain everybody is rewarded, because ultimately we have to have profitable businesses, don't we, in order to do all the things that we need them to do.
Definitely. It always surprises me. Well, I suppose surprises is probably the wrong word. How many different hats farmers have to wear? So even when they're just thinking about, oh, I'm a dairy farmer, I'm a beef farmer, they have to know a little bit about veterinary, they have to know all about finances. Now you're saying that actually a dairy farmer has to think they're a beef farmer too. So you just add another hat into that ring.
Yeah. but actually more and more with the current milk prices the way they are, actually dairy farmers are looking at that beef part of their business because it is contributing to the turnover and potentially overall profits at the moment. So it's worth them engaging and looking at it.
Yeah, once again, it's not looking at anything in isolation, it's looking at the whole enterprise and everything it can offer, isn't it? Now, I suppose that leads me into another aspect where it is thinking about that whole system. And I'm sure many of our listeners will have seen recent discussions around bovine TB following Clarkson's farm and obviously quite how vocal he can be on the topic. That is something that our farmers are having to consider, isn't it, within their systems. Do you think you could talk us through any common misconceptions or misunderstandings about TB that you felt might need a little bit more context?
Yeah, so I guess the question he and Charlie Ireland sort of posed at the end of this current series was, when his TB skin test, IIR, went for slaughter, it didn't have TB. And it's the use of language. And what I do really value that Jeremy Clarkson showed on the programme was the impact that TB has on farmers. It's emotional. It's upsetting. We are slaughtering otherwise fit and healthy animals. And absolutely, I get that. I suppose what I really want people to understand is that TB is just another infectious disease. I know it's not, because it is government sort of tell us how to manage it, not vets and farmers working together. But the key message from that is that the animal, the test that that animal went through, showed that that animal was infected with TB. Then what happens is they go to slaughter, and it's not a post-mortem, an autopsy, as we imagine, kind of everything being going through with a fine tooth comb. It is just a process on that slaughter line to have a brief, quick look to see if there's gross, big lesions for TB. And what the results in that letter said was, we didn't find those really obvious signs of TB disease. And if you remember back to those awful days with COVID, and we had to test before we went anywhere, you could do the test, you were fit and healthy, had no symptoms of COVID, you weren't diseased with COVID, but the test showed you were infected. And so you managed what you did to stop the risk of that spread of infection. And that's what we're trying to do with TB, is stop that animal being able to spread it to the rest of Clarkson's herd, but also potentially being sold on and spreading it to another herd. So as painful as it is when farmers do lose those animals, and it is a massive impact on the business, we do have legislation about how we manage TB, because it is a notifiable disease. Because actually, if you go back through history, it was a big killer of humans in the UK, and actually globally is still one of the biggest infectious disease, respiratory diseases that is killing humans. And that's why we have a global policy, I guess, through the World Organization for Animal Health, that every country that wants to trade has to follow certain rules. So as hard as it is, you know, some of it, we don't have a lot of choice. And I think that's where it impacts the farm businesses. We don't choose when we test. We don't choose what happens to those animals, which is what we do with vets and farmers all the time for other infectious diseases. So the clear message is yes, that animal was infected with TB. The good news was it wasn't heavily infected enough to be diseased and shouldn't have been a big risk to the rest of his herd. So if we can get that message out, that is, I think, is really powerful, because sometimes farmers do feel quite rightly quite disgruntled that we might be killing the wrong animals. And I just want to reassure them that we're not, and that we are doing this because we want to manage TB.
And I think the point I really took from that as well is it's thinking about it from that almost global scale. It's a small part, but within a much wider system, isn't it?
And I think what he did highlight as well, which is really powerful for me having been a vet and for anybody going out and talking to farmers on farm, is that farmers aren't dealing with TB breakdowns in isolation. In the same episode, he talked about his prostate cancer diagnosis. And often farmers are dealing with all sorts of other crap on their farm at the time. And that TB can just be the straw that breaks the camel's back. And there's a lot of poor mental well-being that goes around that. And I think that is everybody's role, is to support those farmers if they hear that they're due a test or they're just being shut down with TB. You know, how can I help you? What can I do to support you? Because it affects people, not just the businesses.
So check in on each other, and I'll make sure that we have some links to some mental health support linked in our show notes. Now, Hal's already briefly touched on it, but any top tips for where people can go to find out a little bit more about GB Calf Week?
So head to the AHDB website and search GB Calf Week and you'll find the full list of events there.
Sarah, Hal, thank you both so much for making your Ag Show debuts on this episode. We'd love to have you back again. But thank you so much.
Thank you.
Thank you.
I don't want to keep banging on about it, guys, but, you know, the name of somebody who listens to the Ag Show, I just want to tell you that there is an Article 27 of the Ag Show Code. So if needs be, I can go to that without anybody else having a say-so, just to let you know.
Is this one that you've recently made up? Was there an Article 26 or even an Article 1 and you just haven't told us about any of these before, Martin?
No, I just think you can get anything done if there's an Article 27 in whatever arena you're in, whether it's Ag Show, football.
In next week's episode, we'll be testing Martin on the rules and regulations of the Ag Show. I don't think you're going to win, Mark, because this is the first time I've heard of an article existing in any set of rules.
Okay, well, I'll see. It's still open for debate. Agshow at ahdb.org.uk for name suggestions for listeners and for content as well, whatever you want to listen to. So whatever we call you, it is your show, and we'd love to make sure that we are getting the subjects that you want to hear under the microscope.
I don't know about you, Charlotte, but I'm going to beg our listeners now to get in touch with some other suggestions. What do you think?
Yes, please. But that is now all we've got time for this week. We've loved having you with us. Do get in contact, agshow@ahdb.org.uk, or on any of our socials with suggestions, names, please.
Please get in touch, please.
Otherwise, we'll see you next week. Catch you then.